This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. You, me, top experts, a virtual meeting room, and 28 minutes. This week, we nearly know who the next US president will be. But what will he do? The US presidential election appears to be almost over, and we appear almost to have a winner. Probably Joe Biden, conceivably not. But what items will the newly elected president have on his must-do list, and how will he set about doing them? It's a question the answer to which matters to just about all of us. So step inside the briefing room, and together we'll find out. We've taken four major areas that seem most likely to have pride of place at the top of the president's in-tray: the economy, foreign affairs, including relations with China, climate change, and handling the pandemic. Let's begin right there. James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. James Fallows, let's say Joe Biden comes in January. His immediate priority, one assumes, will be to deal with the COVID crisis. What do you think he will try to do?
I think he'll try to make the argument that the two crises of the moment, the economic collapse and dealing with the pandemic, are in fact the same crisis, and there's no way to rescue the economy without dealing with the disease. I think he has a large group of people around him on this topic, as with a number of others, who've had experience in past administrations. So I would imagine that he would, as soon as he is in office, assuming he goes into office, set up a pandemic commission, have, you know, six or eight emergency orders ready to go and say, this is what we need to do right now. This is the way to connect with our international partners, with the WHO, with the UN, and here's the way to connect our national enterprises. The 50 states have been more or less left on their own for the past year, so have many cities. So I think it will be a harmonized external and internal policy within the US.
Coordination is one thing, but they've got to coordinate about doing something. Do we have any idea what that approach would be likely to be?
I think a crucial element of it would be getting school children back to school, because I think that's increasingly seen as the most damaging part of the necessary or unnecessary reaction to the pandemic, is what it's done to families and children in public schooling. So I think there'd be priority to that. There'd be some sense of logistics preparation for a vaccine if and when it is ready. You know, I am not myself a pandemic expert, but there are enough people who would say, here are the ways we can tailor policies on distancing and which entities should be opened and closed in different parts of the country that are at different stages in their reaction to the disease.
Now, you mentioned the rolling out the vaccine. Does Joe Biden have the experience in emergency management to organize such a huge capacity?
No individual does, by definition. But again, I think it's worth recognizing, at least in the U.S. context, how very extensively the preceding two administrations, that is preceding Trump, Barack Obama's and George W. Bush's, had prepared for exactly the circumstance the U.S. and the world are going through right now. The Bush administration had extensive playbooks on the ways you would coordinate state and local and hospital and other resources. And Obama extended those. So Biden has around him people who have cut their teeth on this, presumably the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control, epitomized by Anthony Fauci, would be working with the White House as opposed to against the White House. So Biden himself has been part of organizations that have responded in the past.
If it's Donald Trump, if Donald Trump does manage to win, Will we see any significant change in approach to the pandemic?
I think that the hallmark of Donald Trump's approach to the pandemic has essentially been every state for itself, every city for itself. And Trump essentially, increasingly as time has gone on, denying this was an issue at all. That was the theme of his campaign speeches in the last month or two. So presumably it would be an acceleration of that. And in practical terms, I think that would mean states being much more the action points for what can be done and cannot. That's difficult when you have a global phenomenon, but I think that would be one of the upshots of Trump staying in.
Let's talk about some of the wider programs where, if you like, you locate the greatest ambition for the country of a potential Biden administration. What do you think those priorities for Biden will be?
The priorities were summed up as build back better. The idea is to cope with a pandemic, therefore enabling economic recovery and using in that ways that would advance infrastructure repair and environmental sustainability and on down the other list. The reason I said those were the priorities is that it appears as we speak that the Republicans under Mitch McConnell will still control the U.S. Senate. And Mitch McConnell succeeded impressively in blunting a lot of what Barack Obama wanted to do back in 2008, 2009. And unless his agenda changes, he will likely be a speed brake on those things.
Is Biden one of those potential presidents who actually will be able to seduce, work with, win votes, compromise in such a way that he will actually manage to get a portion of his program through?
There is, of course, in mathematics, the famous dividing by zero conundrum that you cannot divide anything by zero. And that is related to the convincing Mitch McConnell conundrum. Biden temperamentally is more likely to view Republican senators as potential wooees, but there are very few, if any, instances in Mitch McConnell's long political career of his being budgeable.
James, finally, it's only since January 2017, that the team that President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden had around them was dispersed. If Joe Biden is back in, can we anticipate Obama 2.0?
I think that Joe Biden, obviously, as a political figure, is completely different from Barack Obama. He is not seen as a transformational figure. He's a generation older. He's a person of the Senate, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that he has this great similarity to Obama of coming in the middle of economic collapse. And I think his instincts will be mainly like those of Obama. Rhetorically, the argument will be summed up as, we are better than this. You can argue whether that's true or not, but that will be the assumption. We can work together. There are ways to find unity. Operationally, I think it will be a centrist left path towards a number of these long-term Democratic Party goals, as opposed to a let's shake everything up path, all the more so since if Biden is in, he will likely deal with a Republican-controlled Senate.
James Fallows, talking there, among other things, about the relationship between the pandemic crisis and the US economy. So what about the economic prospectus more generally? Jared Bernstein is from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and was an economic advisor to Joe Biden when he was vice president. Jared Bernstein, over here in Britain, the economy's been badly hit by the pandemic. What's the state of the US economy?
Well, the recovery here is very much like the letter K, meaning that there are sectors and companies that are actually doing very well. The stock market has generally been trending up, but there is a lot of pain going on in the bottom half of that K. Many families still face very high unemployment, recessionary conditions with income problems, with difficulty making ends meet, paying the rent, meeting their nutritional needs, and government support, which was essential and actually got out the door pretty quickly initially in the spring, has largely faded, and Congress and the Trump administration failed to re-up that needed support.
And are some sectors worse hit than others, some groups of people?
Very much so. If you think about the person-to-person services, restaurant, transportation, some entertainment, at least, you know, in public, not Netflix and stuff. I mean, that they're doing very well. Those sectors have all been hurt, hotels. And if you think about some of the people who work in those sectors, you can connect it to that K-shaped story I was just telling, because many workers in our services over here in the U.S. are paid very low wages. So they really depend on the ability to work enough hours to kind of compensate for their low pay. So they've been the most exposed to this.
Now, I imagine that Joe Biden would want to clamp down significantly on infection rises. And that generally means closing down bits of the economy and restricting them. And given what you've just said, that would seem to act in contradiction to the problems of the poorer workers who he, I believe, has often talked about wanting to help.
Well, except for he has tried to, I think, be quite clear that safe commerce is not the same as no commerce. I don't foresee the American economy shutting down anything like what happened in March and April. What needs to happen is not just reopening, but safe reopening. And that's where I think we need to go with virus control. There are some policies that Biden would love to implement that are complementary to that. So, for example, much more testing. I mean, if we have a national testing program, that's going to be pro-virus control, but also creates more economic activity, which would also be a plus.
So, in other words, one of the first things you would anticipate a Biden administration doing is putting in place a significant relief package.
No question.
Okay, let's take it slightly longer term, if we can kind of raise our perspective beyond the pandemic. What is Biden's longer term plan for the economy? I mean, after all, the one thing where Donald Trump was getting credit from the US electorate in polls was for handling of the economy. And one could imagine that a Biden administration would be very vulnerable to criticism that it wasn't acting as well and wasn't delivering the goods in the same way as that. So what do you understand his plans to be?
Joe Biden actually has one of the most deep economic agendas that any person running for office, and can't say president-elect yet because we just don't know, has had. The buzzword is building back better. But what does that actually mean? What it means is building a much more resilient, inclusive economy on the other side of the crisis. We now have an economy that is clearly vulnerable to shocks of the type that we've seen coming fast and furiously in recent years. Some of this is pre-pandemic. If you look at the impact of climate change on the weather, on storms, on wildfires, if you look at the impact of inequality, racial injustice, you'll see real hardship in our economy, even amidst the positive macroeconomic results that you correctly pointed to. But then you layer on the pandemic and you see a health system, an unemployment insurance system that really needs a lot of work. And this agenda, with its deep investments in clean energy, in healthcare, in racial justice, in housing, in education, in more worker power, that's targeted right at, I would say, the heart of that non-resiliency problem.
Now, all the things that you've mentioned are classic spending areas. They're not classic making areas or earning areas. So what is the Biden plan for building up the U.S. economy so as to be able to afford these measures?
There's one area that your comment made me think of, which is infrastructure. So we've long disinvested in our public goods, everything from roads, bridges, clean energy investments, water systems in this country, or for that matter, I'm talking about physical capital, human capital, education. There are a lot of Republicans who want to work with Democrats on this, believe it or not, but what's been lacking is presidential leadership. And Biden, should he become the president, will definitely bring that back into that picture. He's been a long-time advocate of public investment in those sorts of spaces.
Now, one thing I'm really interested in about the Green New Deal is whether or not it manages to replace jobs in the places where they've been lost.
One of the things that Biden talked about, it resonated, was this idea that when certain conservatives, certainly President Trump, hear this idea of climate change and climate mitigation, They think hoax, and Biden thinks jobs. In fact, Biden himself asked me, I was informally advising the campaign, to write him a memo on the types of jobs that are invoked by the kinds of clean energy investments that he envisions. Turns out you find jobs all throughout the spectrum. That's one of the really interesting and underappreciated thing about green jobs. These are jobs for laborers. These are jobs for blue and pink collar workers. These are jobs for college educated workers, for non-college educated workers. So it's a very wide span there in terms of the occupational opportunities. Now, folks moving from one sector to another, that can happen, but these changes tend to be much more gradual than sometimes the political debate suggests. It's not like you go to bed Friday and you have, you know, one set of sectors producing energy and you wake up Monday and you have a totally different one. Transitions are much more gradual than that. And it is the role of the government to help them be less painful for people who are displaced.
If we just move briefly to the international scene, is there a renewed global leadership role for the US when it comes to the world economy?
Yes, there's just a tremendous amount of anxiety among our traditional allies. And Joe Biden has a long history, of course, of working in coalition with our traditional partners.
Jared Bernstein. One area of complete discontinuity between the administration in which Joe Biden served and the one currently in power is that of foreign policy. So what now? Leslie Vinjamuri is director of U.S. and the Americas at Chatham House.
Vice President Biden has made it very clear over the last several months that he intends to marshal a team that is very committed to taking America right back into the world as a one amongst many partners seeking to really lead the way on the big global challenges. He's taken climate very seriously. He has a very significant plan. But I think what we're going to see across any number of dimensions, whether it's recommitting to the transatlantic partnership and bringing America back into the World Health Organization, we're going to see a president that really wants to solve those problems with others, as opposed to exerting a kind of naked self-interest of the kind that we've seen for the past 4 years.
Is it fair to say that the kind of outlook there was under the Obama administration is going to be reasserted to the extent that a significant proportion of the kind of people who were in post as recently as January 2017 may well find themselves coming back in?
Yes, I do think that we will see a number of people who we're very familiar with. The team that is well-schooled, that is experienced, that's very internationalist. But Vice President Biden knows he's facing a different world, and he is a different president. He's much more inclined towards Europe. He's more of a transatlanticist. He's more European in his outlook. President Obama really wasn't. He certainly came closer to Europe in the end, but his instincts were not especially European. The other thing that's very different is that, of course, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the American people have changed on some very big issues. And perhaps the most obvious one is on trade and America's role in the global economy. People expect a much tougher bargain. And there's really no going back, even if Vice President Biden looks to getting America back into the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's already become something different.
Just to take you up on the point about Joe Biden's transatlanticism, what concrete differences might that entail?
Vice President Biden's closest advisors, many of them have lived abroad. They've lived in Germany. I think one concern that the United Kingdom has is that a Biden presidency will really look to Germany first as the key partner in Europe because it's in the EU, because of its economic importance, because of its geographical location. This is actually a concern that Britain's had for a long time, right? That even when it was in the EU, even before the referendum, there's always been this lurking concern that America is going to take more interest in Germany. But what we've seen at the end of the day is that America cares about the UK. And I think the importance of the UK as a security partner and is so important to intelligence, all of these things are deeply ingrained in Biden's historical experiences and understanding of the importance and the significance of working with Europe.
If Trump somehow remains in power, will he retreat further over the next 4 years, do you think, from global leadership positions?
first of all, you know, President Trump has not retreated from the global stage. If anything, America has been more bullish. It's been more self-interested. It's been very assertive. But he's certainly retreated from global leadership and from multilateralism. If he has four more years in office, we are going to see more of this, right? A president that is very bullish about America getting what America wants, especially when it comes to tariffs, bilateral trade. I think the one very important caveat that I would add to that is that this is a president who I think really actually would like to get a Nobel Peace Prize. And, you know, I've been scanning the globe, and he has too, by the way, to see where he can get that. And it's not North Korea, right? He's tried and failed. It's not looking like it's going to be Afghanistan. But I think where he will double down is in America's investment in getting some sort of peace deal with Israel and Palestine and expanding the Abraham Accords, you know, between Israel and to include possibly Saudi if he can get it. But I think he really wants that region to be where he makes his mark.
I want to come on specifically to China. We have gone into, and it's not just the United States, into what at some points looked like becoming a new Cold War. Now, how would a Biden White House play this one?
American attitudes have hardened considerably towards China, not least over the summer during the pandemic. But I think there are many people who are on Biden's foreign policy team of advisors who are very clear that the Cold War is the wrong analogy, right? This is not a Cold War. This is not a conflict in which America doesn't have very serious interests in making sure that there is engagement with China. There's a real emphasis coming out of the Biden team that we're in a different world and China's a very different actor than the former Soviet Union was.
I read that as meaning that the Biden White House stance towards China is going to sound more like the Trump approach than the Obama approach did because times have changed.
Yeah, I mean, times have changed, China has changed, and America has changed. But I think it would be a mistake to say that they're the same. You know, most of Donald Trump's efforts were very narrowly focused on a tariff war with China. But I think what you'll see is a much more considered, comprehensive approach to China, whether it's the technology question, national security, trade, market access, intellectual property, human rights, democracy. I mean, there's some real challenges in actually implementing that kind of policy because it will be very serious. But there's also a clear recognition that you cannot move forward on the key global challenges and most significantly climate change. China is the essential partner with America to moving that forward.
Leslie Vinjamuri. A second area of total rupture between Obama and Trump was over climate change. How are things likely to shape up here? Tom Hale is Associate Professor in Public Policy at the University of Oxford. Tom Hale, can you describe how America's commitment to tackling climate change changed over the last 4 years when Donald Trump has been president? And let's talk domestically first.
Well, Donald Trump came into the presidency calling it a Chinese hoax, as you may recall. So expectations were low. And indeed, those low expectations were met or even exceeded in terms of his domestic agenda. There were three big things that he did to undo some of the Obama era regulations. First, he reversed the Clean Power Plan, which was the plan under Obama to reduce emissions from coal plants, gas plants, other kinds of power plants in the United States. He also reduced the efficiency of American cars by removing some standards the Obama people had put in to make cars more efficient. And he had reduced regulations on methane leakage from pipelines, which is a big source of emissions as well.
Do we know what the effect actually was on American carbon emissions?
So the irony here is that Donald Trump came in with these big promises, but he wasn't particularly effective. All of these rollbacks of regulations were immediately challenged in the courts, and that really weakened their effect. And if you look at his, for example, his pledge to bring back coal, well, American coal production actually reduced by like 10% in the first 3 years of his presidency before the pandemic. But what it has done is to really slow down the momentum toward transition that was beginning to build up in the Obama administration. But if you look at the bottom line, U.S. emissions have actually declined by half a percentage point in the first 3 years of Donald Trump's presidency. Under Trump, we saw huge action on climate change by cities and states, business, private sector in general. And if you think about it, You know, it's not just the blue states that have taken on these measures. One of the greatest renewable energy stories in the United States is in Texas. Texas has a huge amount of solar and wind driving down the cost of electricity and actually promoting a pretty brisk transition away from oil.
So now let's talk about the Biden plan. If indeed he becomes president, what would we anticipate that he would actually get to seek to be done? And what would be the obstacles in the way of him doing those things?
So Joe Biden came into this election promising the biggest package on climate change any American presidential candidate has ever done. So if he indeed takes over the presidency in January of next year, there's two very different scenarios. One where he wins the presidency and the Democrats take the Senate, and one where that doesn't happen with the Senate. In the former case, there's still quite a lot that can be done. All those regulations that Donald Trump had rolled back can be unrolled back. There's also a lot, though, that will need to be done through legislation, and that's where it gets more complicated. Ambitious policies, particularly ones involving large amounts of spending, that's going to be much more challenging under the second scenario.
So which aspects of his program are much less likely to be enacted if there is a Republican majority in the Senate that seems likely?
I think some of the things that'll be hardest to do will be any kind of carbon pricing. So a carbon tax or a cap and trade system, that will be very difficult to take forward under a Republican Senate. Some of the things that could be also hard would be around promoting a just transition. So a lot of the Biden climate plan has been around helping communities that are being affected by climate change, for example, coastal communities or people living near wildfires, and also helping workers who are going to have to transition to a new industry to find an effective package of support to help them make that transition. One of the unknowns going forward is what the role of the U.S. Supreme Court will be in its new configuration. Under 4 years of Donald Trump, the courts have actually been quite good for climate change by slowing down or even challenging some of the rollbacks that Donald Trump tried to bring through. But now we're facing a federal judiciary and a Supreme Court that have been completely changed by the Republican Senate over the last 4 years and by Donald Trump's appointments. And that means that any regulatory policy Democrats try to bring forward will almost certainly be challenged in court and maybe tied up for several years. It's not so much going to be a total obstacle to action as sort of a clamp or a brake on the speed of action.
Let's go to the international stage. One of the things that Donald Trump did early in his presidency was withdraw from the Paris Agreement. Now, first, could you just remind our listeners what the Paris Agreement does?
The Paris Agreement is an international treaty negotiated in 2015 that commits every single country in the world to find their way to ultimately net zero emissions. The United States formally left the Paris Agreement just yesterday, one day after the election. But it was interesting, yesterday, despite all the election stuff going on, Joe Biden still found the time to tweet that the United States will be rejoining the Paris Agreement in 77 days' time if I'm elected president.
How important a commitment is that in international terms?
It's a very important symbolic commitment. The United States is currently the only country in the entire world that is not a party to this treaty. And that's a hugely consequential thing because the United States is the world's largest economy and the second largest emitter. Interestingly, though, the world has kind of moved on in some ways and hasn't been waiting for the United States to come back to begin to take action further. We've seen a huge amount of net zero commitments coming up from across Europe, but also in Japan and Korea and even in China. And that suggests that U.S. leadership, while certainly an important boost to efforts to avert climate change, may not be as necessary as we might have thought in 2016 when Trump was first elected.
Yeah, because all the talk used to be, how are you going to get the Chinese to do any of this? And U.S. leadership was needed to broker that. But that doesn't seem to be so necessary.
Well, I think it's going to be an important part of making that Chinese commitment effective and transparent. Without the United States at the negotiating table, we can expect fewer voices calling for robust transparency on these commitments and firm standards around them in the UN talks. So that's an important ally to have on that side of the issue. And that creates a good opportunity for the United States to come back in a credible way because it needs to do some hard work to restore trust after these last 4 years on climate change.
Tom Hale. And my conclusion, it might not look like it right now, but winning, as ever in politics, was probably the easy part. My thanks to Leslie Bingemuri, Tom Hale, Jared Bernstein and James Fallows. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Richard Fenton-Smith, Kirsty Knight and Simon Coates. The programme was mixed by Rod Farker and the editor was Jasper Corbett. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. If you enjoyed it, you may find other episodes interesting, including Coronavirus, The Return to School, 6 months in, what we have learned about the virus, and what happens if the US election result is contested. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumors, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day, and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.